Boker Tov, good morning. This morning I'd like to explore together with you one of the most controversial debates of the last century and a half, a controversy that we'll see is not very new. In fact, it's really based on an older controversy some centuries before, but it's a controversy that rears its head every 7 years, a controversy that's so divisive. And as we'll see together this morning, it's a controversy that in many ways has shaped the landscape of religious and political life as we know it today here in the modern state of Israel, the Heter Mechira. With the miraculous return of the Jewish people home to Eretz Israel, which begins in the late 19th century, many questions arose that for 2,000 years laid dormant, for 2,000 years were but the subject of our dreams, of our hopes. Among them was the question, how will we observe Shemitah? Long before Theodor Herzl publishes his tract, Der Judenstaat, in 1896, decades before the founding of the Zionist movement, or the first Zionist Congress of 1897, there were rabbis and religious leaders in Europe, Mivasrei Tzion, heralders of Zion. Scholars and historians would later dub them proto-Zionists because they came before the secular Zionists, who were encouraging their flock to return to the land of Israel, to roll up their sleeves, build up the land, till her soil, and bring about the Geulah, usher in the redemption. Already in the late 18th century, you have the Gaon Mivilna, the Vilna Gaon, Elijah of Vilna, encouraging his students and followers to return to the land of Israel. He believed that the redemption is coming b'derech hateva, through the natural order, the natural process, through a natural means. He believed that the atchalta degula, the beginning of redemption, was already there, the ikvita de mashicha, the footsteps of the Mashiach, of the Messiah, could already be heard, as his students record. And he sent his students on Aliyah anticipating the arrival of the Mashiach in the year 1840, based on statements of the Zohar and the Midrashic literature. Unfortunately, that did not happen. The Mashiach did not come in 1840, but the Talmidei Hagra did manage to create a Jewish majority here in Jerusalem in the mid-19th century and resettle and rebuild parts of the old city, as well as other parts of Israel. If you're interested in more on the story of the Aliyah of the Talmidei Hagra, Aryeh Morgenstern has really done a fabulous job. It's really been his life's work, published an exhaustive amount of material in articles, scholarly articles and books on the subject. And at the same time, of course, you had the Talmidei HaBaal Shem Tov settling in the north in places like Tzfat and Tveria. A little bit later on, you had visionaries, Mivasrei Tzion, like Rav Yehuda Alkalai of Serbia, who's the Rav in Belgrade, where Theodor Herzl's paternal grandfather, Shimon Loeb Herzl Davind, by the way, and he owned Alkalai's Sfarim. Herzl's family had other connections with early religious Zionist thinkers. Many historians and scholars will downplay this, but it's very possible that this influenced Herzl's Zionism and his vision. Ritzi Hirsch Kalischer, who was the Rav in, he was a Rav in Prussia, today Poland. He was a Talmid of Rabbi Akiva Eger. He sent letters to Rabbonim, leading poskim, his Rebbe, Rabbi Akiva Eger, the Chassam Sofer, philanthropists, encouraging a return to Tzion. He wanted to see a restoration of the Avodah. He discussed the possibilities of bringing Korbanot, Bizman Hazeh, even before a Beit HaMikdash was built. And this flurry of letters really begins this whole discussion of returning to Eretz Yisrael and bringing Korbanot and rebuilding the Beit HaMikdash, and forms the basis for his Sefer Drishat Tzion. Many of you are familiar with his Sefer Drishat Tzion. Kibbutz Tir HaTzvi, of course, is named for Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. You had Eliyahu Guttmacher, also a Talmud of Rabbi Kiva Eger, among the Mevasrei Tzion, these elders of Zion, these early religious Zionist thinkers. The kibbutz Sde Eliyahu is named for Eliyahu Guttmacher. I mentioned Rabbi Kiva Eger and his son-in-law through the Chasam Sofer's second marriage, Zivuk Sheni, the Chasam Sofer. The two of them are discussing coming to Israel, restoring the Avodah, all of these questions, the permissibility of Korbanot. As I mentioned, a little bit later on, you have Rav Shmuel Mohalever, who was the Rav in Bialystok and one of the founders of the Chovavei Tzion movement, also called Chibat Tzion movement. Kibbutz Gan Shmuel is named for Rav Shmuel Mohalever. There's a wonderful museum in Maskeret Batya, which we'll talk about a little bit later on this morning, Maskeret Batya. He was one of the founders of Maskeret Batya. And there's a wonderful museum there, which talks about his life and the founding of Maskeret Batya, and there's a lot on his life there, and it's a wonderful, wonderful place to visit if you've been there before. But in May 1882, you have a series of laws known as the May Laws, which are passed by Tsar Alexander III, which restrict Jews to live in the Pale of Settlement, prohibit Jews from living outside of large cities and towns. The May laws prohibit Jews from owning or managing property, leasing land, operating their businesses on Sundays or other Christian holidays. Now you can imagine if you're Jewish and you can't open your business on Shabbos because it's Shabbos, how Sunday would be an important day for commerce. In fact, you have in certain places in the United States, I grew up in northern New Jersey, and in Bergen County, you have the Blue Laws, they're called, still to this day, where all stores are closed on Sundays. It's difficult for a Jewish shopkeeper. I think today there are certain dispensations, maybe if you're a small business owner. In any case, so these May laws were, of course, preceded by and coincided with and followed by many awful pogroms in Russia, which leads to a major emigration from Russia and from Eastern Europe to the United States and Eretz Israel. And between 1881 and 1914, you have more than 2.5 million Jews leaving their homes in Eastern Europe for a better life in America or Israel. That's when my family came to the United States. I'm sure many of you have a similar story. Okay, your grandfather. And this, of course, also ushers in, it coincides with the first Aliyah, which took place between 1881 and 1903, which was partly a result of these May laws and partly inspired by these Mevasrei Tzion, these visionaries, but also inspired by these May laws. Jews from Russia and Eastern Europe were escaping these laws, escaping pogroms. And you had an estimated 25 to 35,000 Jews from Eastern Europe, together with a small contingent from Iraq and Yemen, come on Aliyah to Israel. This is the first Aliyah, which for the most part were traditional and religious Jews. And this is really where our story begins. The first Shemitah of real significance for our discussion this morning is the Shemitah of 5642. That translates to 1881, 1882. By then, you already had the settlement of Petach Tikva, which was founded. It was founded in 1878. Petach Tikva, known as the Eim HaMoshavot, the mother of these agricultural settlements, was founded by religious Jews from the old city of Jerusalem, members of the old Yishuv. Okay, this is before the first Aliyah. This is before that wave. This is already in 1878. And among its founders, you Hoshua Stampfer, who I saw somewhere, reportedly walked on foot from Hungary to Jerusalem. Incredible. Moshe Shmuel Rab, Yol Moshe Solomon, of course you're familiar with that name, Ariel Leib Frumkin, and Zerach Barnett, which has a special significance in my life because that's the name of the street that I live on in Harnov. It's named for Zerach Barnett. He also had a small settlement in Motza, also very nearby where I live in Harnov, really just below Harnov in the foothills of the Jerusalem forest. You can visit the synagogue there. There's a sign, the ancient synagogue of Mozart. It's really not so ancient. It's from the 19th century, but it's nice anyway. I was there not too long ago for Bris. So in that year, or in advance of that Shemitah year, Shemitah 5642, 1881, 1882, the nascent yeshuv, the settlements like Petach Tikva and Moza, which were founded by religious Jews, they consulted with the Rav at the time, Rav Shmuel Salant, the undisputed Rav of the old yeshuv. He was born in 1816, and Bialystok arrives in Jerusalem in 1841. And with the death of his father-in-law in 1865, he's appointed Rav of the Ashkenazi community here in Jerusalem. And he paskined, we are obligated to keep the laws of Shemitah, keep the Shemitah laws. You can't work your land, you can't sell its produce. And that proved to be very challenging at the time. There was famine, there was hunger, there was disease, there was malaria, of course. And the settlers of Petach Tikva fled Petach Tikva. They left Petach Tikva, some of them finding refuge in another settlement nearby, Yehud, which had been set up by those who had already settled first in Petach Tikva. And it's unclear whether it was the malaria that did them in, or whether it was the Shemitah that did them in. I've seen both accounts in the history books. Petach Tikva was resettled a few years later with the help of Baron Edmund James D. Rothschild, who we're going to talk about a lot this morning, who pays to have the swamp drained. Okay? Was it Trump when he was running? His campaign slogan was he was gonna drain the swamp. He was gonna make America great again, but he was gonna also drain the swamp. Well, I don't know if he accomplished that, but Rothschild certainly did. He managed to drain the swamp, and Rothschild is the patron of the nascent yeshuv here at the time. And ultimately, Petach Tikva is resettled and becomes an Ir Ve'em B'Yisrael. Now it's one of Israel's major cities. I don't have to tell you. But following these Maylaws, which we mentioned, and a series of pogroms, Rav Shmuel Mohalever, again, one of the Mevasrei Tzion, the heralders of Zion, one of these great early religious Zionist thinkers and visionaries and pioneers, he helps found the Chovevei Tzion movement in Warsaw in 1881. Now, Chovevei Tzion was an interesting organization that I don't think could exist today, because it was really a bridge between religious and secular working together. Even back then, ultimately, it didn't work, and the religious faction in the Chovevei Tzion broke away to form the Mizrahi. But at the time, it worked. Mohalever, together with Pinsker, they found Chovevei Tzion in Warsaw in 1881, and Mohalever was the Rav in Bialystok. He encouraged his flock, his students, to move to Petach Tikva, to settle in the land of Israel, establishing agricultural communities there. He convinces Baron Edmund James D. Rothschild to support a newly founded settlement called Ekron, which becomes Maskeret Batya. Ekron is founded in 1883. In 1887, the name was changed to Maskeret Batya in memory of Betty Solomon D. Rothschild, Baron Rothschild's mother. Okay, he's the one who gave all the money, so of course you have to name it after his mother. Now, Rothschild was heavily invested in these settlements. And by now, and in advance of the next Shemitah year, you have all of these agricultural settlements springing up because of all of these Jews arriving during the first Aliyah. Okay, and this becomes the new yeshuv. Places like, well, we mentioned Petach Tikva and Maskeret Batya already, but places like Rishon LeZion, Zichron Yaakov, Nes Tziona, Rosh Pina, and Yisod Hamala in the north. You may have heard of some of these places. They're still around to this very day. So, as I mentioned, the overwhelming majority of these Jews who came and the first Aliyah came from traditional religious Jewish families. And this first Aliyah was inspired about a connection to the land of their ancestors, in addition to fleeing the persecution in Eastern Europe as well, of course. But this is before secular Zionism, really. This is before secular Zionism. So the values are very different, and they come with these very romantic values and ideals and ideas of working the land and tilling her soil and draining the swamps. Some of them were better equipped to do that. Some of them had experience as farmers back in Europe. Others were less equipped for this, and they relied on the support of Rothschild. I mean, you know, what does a Jew know about farming? I don't know. I grew up in New Jersey. What do I know? But some of these Jews actually did have a background. In fact, there was even training. Mohalever and others encouraged Jews to get trained in farming before they arrived on her soil in Eretz Israel. There are farms in New Jersey, correct, but not where I lived. Yes, you are right. All right. I visited them. There's some up north. There's some down south. Yes, yes. Interesting. That's fascinating. So again, they faced tremendous challenges, hunger, starvation, disease, malaria. And while this first Aliyah was a major ideological success, it proved to be a financial disaster. And I've seen different estimates, you know, scholars and historians will debate as to how many of these chalutzim returned or didn't stay in Israel. But there are estimates, you know, of over 50%, some even of more, of these pioneers that ultimately did not stay in the land of Israel because the conditions were too difficult. Remember, this was before Nefesh B'Nefesh. So in advance of the next Shemitah, which was 5649, 1888-1889, Baron Rothschild, who was now heavily invested in the new Yishuv, was asked, what are we going to do? You know, it's not clear exactly how much he knew. He was a traditional Jew. How much halacha or Torah he knew? Did he understand Shemitah and its intricacies? But there was this expectation that he was going to support financially these agricultural settlements during this full year of Shemitah and beyond. Because, of course, if you can't work your land for an entire year, right, the next year until you can finally plant and until you can finally reap and harvest the produce, it takes time. That's why the Torah, of course, promises that if you keep the Shemitah, if you ask, what am I going to eat? Right? If you keep the Shemitah, the Torah promises that in the sixth year, you'll have a surplus of 3 years, as we mentioned. You'll have enough to sustain you for the sixth year, the seventh year, and into the eighth year as well. So Rothschild was asked to, or it was assumed that he was going to support these agricultural settlements. He said, hey, we can't work the land, Shemitah. So he wanted to find a solution, obviously. As I said, he was heavily invested in this new yeshuv. I've seen mentions of tens of millions of dollars, up to hundreds of millions of dollars back then in late 19th century currency. Imagine what that would mean today. It's hard to fathom, hard to imagine how much money he invested. He actually believed that that it would be a good investment. He was a businessman. He wasn't only a Zionist. So in April and May of 1888, Rothschild visits Jerusalem and meets with Rav Shmuel Salant, who we mentioned is the Rav of the Ashkenazi community here in Yerushalayim, and discusses keeping Shemitah. Rav Salant also discusses Trumot, Ma'asrot, how to find a way to support the Yishuv, and it seemed like Rothschild was on board. But according to some historians, there was a lot that got lost in translation or in transmission, because Rav Salant spoke Yiddish and Rothschild spoke French, and they had an interpreter. And you could imagine going back and forth between Yiddish and French, what that would sound like. And so it's possible that things got lost in translation. In any case, by October of 1888, it seemed like either Rothschild didn't understand Rav Shmuel Salant, or maybe he had changed his mind by then. Because, again, he was concerned what's going to happen to all these settlements. He was heavily invested. In addition, he was concerned for his own ego. Now, Rothschild was heavily criticized by his contemporaries, his colleagues, his peers in Europe, and was afraid that should these settlements fail, wow, that would be a major bruise to his ego. How would he be able to look his peers in the eyes after that? And he also wanted to move the yeshuv away from this old model of the chalukah, where they would collect money from Europe and, you know, live based on handouts. I don't know if today in 2021, 5781, we've completely moved away from support from Jews abroad. But in any case, that was Rothschild's vision. He wanted these agricultural settlements to be completely independent. Okay. And he goes back to Rav Shmuel Salant in October of 1888. Here, this is already the fall. Shemitah is quickly approaching. It's almost Rosh Hashanah. And Rav Salant was very clear. No, you have to follow the laws of Shemitah. We'll have to raise money. And by the way, this is an approach. We'll talk about this more maybe next week. This is an approach that you still have today. We should follow Shemitah to a T, and we'll raise money and support financially those Jewish farmers who are observing Shemitah on their land. So he goes back to Rav Shmuel Salant, and Rav Shmuel Salant gives him a very clear no. He goes to Rav Yehoshua Leib Diskin, who by now had arrived in Israel in 1877 and established himself as the Brisker Rav of Yerushalayim. Also a big emphatic no from Rav Yehoshua Leib Diskin. So what does Rothschild do? He goes to his own Rav, Rav Tzadok Khan, who is the chief rabbi of Paris. Now, chief rabbi of Paris, no, okay, that's a big kavod, but this Rav Tzadok Khan was not recognized as one of the Gedolei Hador. So Rav Tzadok Khan, the chief rabbi of Paris himself, turns to one of the leading poskim at the time, one of the Gedolei Hador, someone recognized as a major authority, Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who lived from 1817 to 1896. Who was 1817 to 1896 and recognized as one of the leading poskim at the time. The yeshiva where I studied and David studied, Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, YU, was named for Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. In fact, if you go into the YU library, there's a whole wing that's dedicated to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. They have this wonderful exhibit with his picture, and there's a line there. I remember, if I'm getting it correctly, something like a modern Rash Kibahag. What is Rash Kibahag? Rav Shel Kol Bnei Hagola, the authority of the entire diaspora. That's how he was recognized. That's the, you know, the esteem that was attributed to him. He was considered one of the major gedolim at the time. And it was Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, based on, as I'll mention in a few moments, an earlier tshuva, who came up with the idea of the heter mechira, selling the land of Israel, selling land, a plot of land, selling your field in the land of Israel to a non-Jew in order to remove the obligation of Shemitah from that land, to allow you, or perhaps, according to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, a non-Jew to work that land and to sell its produce and to be able to provide for yourself and your family. Again, this was a major challenge at the time. You had these nascent agricultural settlements, these nascent moshavot, and people were barely surviving. They were starving. There was famine, rain. I've seen discussions. There was no rain, disease, malaria, etc. So, you know, people erroneously think that it was Rav Kook who invented the Heter Mechira. But the Heter Mechira, it was long before Rav Kook. Mirtz Hashem, we'll get to Rav Kook. We'll talk about what happens when Rav Kook comes to Israel in 1904. But it's really Rav Yitzchok Elchanan Spector, based on an earlier tshuva, who comes up with this concept of heter mechira, and initially he was hesitant about implementing it. One major concern, something that we've discussed previously, was a controversy that took place in Tzfat centuries before. In the 16th century, the dispute between the Beit Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, and the Mabit, Rabbi Moshe ben Yosef Mitrani. Okay, a controversy between the Batei Din of Tzfat and the Batei Din of Yerushalayim. A controversy that invoked haramim and excommunications and bans. A controversy over whether Gentile ownership, non-Jewish ownership over the land of Israel, removes its obligation from the laws of Shemitah. Is the land obligated or is the individual obligated? If it's the land, well, it doesn't matter who owns the land. The land has to rest. V'shavta ha'aretz Shabbat l'Hashem. And its produce has kedushat shvit no matter who owns it. But if the mitzvah is on the individual, so then if the land is owned by a Gentile, the land is not obligated. Even if it's here, the land of Israel, it's not obligated in the mitzvot of Shemitah. Now, they were actually discussing this debate between the Beit Yosef and the Mabit was over whether land, they were not discussing the heter mechira. They were not discussing whether you can sell a plot of land or a field in the land of Israel to a Gentile. They were discussing what happens if a Gentile owns the land. What is the status of the produce? If the land is obligated in Shemitah, Shemitah applies. Well, we know that during Shemitah, everything is hefker, everything is ownerless. The land belongs to Hashem. And anyone who wants can come take the produce of that land, come take the fruits. It doesn't belong to me. It's not my field for that entire year. Okay? And because it's hefker, it's ownerless, so I don't have to tithe that produce. I don't have to bring trumotu ma'asrot. I don't have to tithe. Why? Because something that is hefker is not obligated in being tithed. I can make the pomegranate trees and the lemon trees that are in my garden hefker. I can declare them as ownerless, even in a non-Shemitah year, and I don't have to tithe the produce because it doesn't belong to me. Any Kohen or Levi or poor person could come and take. So the dispute between the Beit Yosef and the Mabit was really over whether land owned by a Gentile is obligated in the laws of Shemitah vis-a-vis the Trumot u'Ma'asrot, right? Well, it is the land of Shemitah because non-Jewish land, right? Land that's owned by a Jew during the Shemitah year, right? You don't have to remove the Trumot u'Ma'asrot. Why? Because it's hefker, everything's hefker. But what if that land is owned by a non-Jew? Do you say that even though it's owned by a non-Jew, the laws of Shemitah apply to the land? The land is obligated, and therefore you don't have to remove the Trumot u'Ma'asrot? Or no, since it's owned by a non-Jew, so what? That releases the obligation of the land. So what? So Shemitah does not apply, and therefore you do have to remove the Trumot u'Ma'asrot. Right? Because Shemitah doesn't apply to that land. And assuming the latter, that land owned by a non-Jew is not subject to the laws of Shemitah, oh, maybe we can then sell the land to a non-Jew for the entirety of the year and therefore release the land from its obligations. And that land can be worked and that field can be planted and produce can be harvested and sold. Okay, so the machloket, this whole debate, this whole dispute, one of the major points of contention was really a dispute that took place centuries before in the 16th century, a dispute between Rav Yosef Karo, the Beit Yosef, and the Mabit over whether the obligation is on the land or on the individual. And if the obligation is on the individual, land owned by a non-Jew, well, a non-Jew is not obligated in the laws of Shemitah, and therefore his land is exempt. So I can sell my land to a non-Jew and release its obligation from the laws of Shemitah. Yes, question. Let's hold that question. We'll revisit this. Okay. I don't want to confuse you too much this morning, but all I wanted to raise right now is that this was one of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector's concerns and hesitations, and not just him, but others as well. Do we indeed say that land owned by a non-Jew is exempt from the laws of Shemitah, or no? The land has kedusha. The land is obligated no matter who owns the land. Okay, that is the nikudat ha-machloket, the point of contention. And as I said, it's really based on an earlier machloket. Okay. So, in the meanwhile, Rav Shmuel Mohalever is really trying to do his best from abroad to support Maskeret Batya and these other moshavot and ensure their that they thrive and that they stay alive and survive the Shemitah. He meets with two other major gedolim at the time to get their support. Rav Yehoshua Trunk, or Trenk of Kutno, he's the author of the Sefer Yeshua Malko, and Rav Shmuel Zanvil Klapfish, who is the Av Beit Din of Warsaw. And they discussed and debated, and, you know, again, some of their concerns was, does selling the land to a non-Jew in fact release the land of its obligation, or is the land obligated no matter who owns it? Other concerns, are you even allowed to sell the land of Israel to a non-Jew? There's an Isur Torah. There's a Torah prohibition. A pasuk in the Torah, Lo Techonem, we read it just a few weeks ago. You're not allowed to show favor or grace, where Chazal have a number of interpretations, a number of drashot. Among them, Lo Titein Lehem Chanaya Bakarka. You're not allowed to give land or sell land to a non-Jew. Now, there's a rich discussion and debate. We'll talk more about it next week. Does that apply to all Gentiles, or maybe only to idolaters? Perhaps the Isur, the prohibition, only applies to idolaters. You can't sell the land to idolaters. What about if the sale is only for a year and it's not permanent? Maybe that, you know, exempts you from the prohibition of Lo Techonem. What if the whole purpose of the sale is to ensure Jewish life, to preserve these settlements, to ensure that they continue to thrive, okay? So a rich discussion ensued, but ultimately, Rav Yehoshua Trunk and Rav Shmuel Zanvil Klapfish come on board. And they made a compromise. They agreed and allowed the Heter Mechira on condition that they only permit certain malachot, certain forbidden activities which are only rabbinically prohibited. Only Isurei Melacha D'Rabbanan. We know that on during the year of Shemitah, there are Avot Melachot, just like on Shabbos, right? There, we've got Avot, or categories. We've got Torah prohibitions. And then there are Toladot, which, with regards to Shemitah, at least, those Toladot are rabbinic, the Gemara explains. It's different from Shabbos. But in any case, they came to a compromise. They would allow the Heter Mechira, but limit it to only certain activities which were rabbinically prohibited. And if you take a look at the sheet there that I gave you, I Xeroxed it from Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon's fascinating work on Shemitah. It's available both in Hebrew and in English. Okay, I have both. Sometimes the English translation is not so clear, so you have to go back to the original Hebrew. Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon, just such a gaon, such an incredible posek. He was just recently, just the other day, it was announced he was appointed the chief rabbi of the entire Gush Etzion. But I don't have to speak his praises. You're all familiar with him, but he writes with such clarity. So here in his book, you have the text of the original Heter Mechira signed by Rav Yehoshua Trunk of Kutna, Rav Shmuel Mohalever, and Rav Shmuel Zanvil Klapfish, the Av Beit Din of Warsaw. And so we'll read it together. Inasmuch as we are drawing near to the Shemitah year, according to the Rambam's calculation and common custom, namely 5649, may it come to us for a blessing. And with God's help, we've been privileged that several villages called colonies, Moshavot, have been established by Jews who support themselves by working the land, both from grain crops and vineyards. And if we forbid them to work the land and tend to the vineyards, the land will become desolate. And this will, God forbid, lead to the destruction of the colonies, and hundreds of people will, God forbid, fade away in hunger. Therefore, in order to save lives and Jewish settlement of this land, lives as well as property, we have found an allowance for this year, 5649, to sell the fields and vineyards and everything connected to working the land to Gentiles. That sale to take effect this summer, may it come upon us for blessing, with the stipulation that when we return their down payment following the Shemitah year, they will be obligated to return our fields and vineyards and everything connected to them. Now that stipulation, we'll see, was also controversial in the subject of tremendous opposition. How can you require them? How can you stipulate that the land is going to revert back in the very contract? Okay. Well, no, because with Mechirat Chametz, some compared this to Mechirat Chametz, by the way. We'll talk about that. But you see, with Mechirat Chametz, we just say if the Gentile doesn't come up with the money, right, we extend him a loan to make sure that he can be in a position to even pay for the Chametz. Otherwise, the whole thing is a legal fiction. However, he has to pay off the loan by a certain date. If he doesn't pay off the loan by a certain date, right? Yeah, so there's this what you'd call a fault clause or default. So what happens? With Mechirat Chametz, the Gentile doesn't come up, whatever it is, an hour after Pesach is over, with the money to pay back the loan which he received in order to purchase the Chametz. So the Chametz reverts to its owners. That's very different, though. That is a legal device which says if you don't pay for it, okay. If the Gentile comes up with the money, right, if he has, you know, millions of dollars, whatever it is, tens of millions, hundreds, I don't know how much it is to buy the entire state of Israel's chametz, gesundehe, he could have my kids' Cheerios, right? I don't need them. Let him pay for it, okay? But he's got to, of course, give me the money, right? He's got to give me the money if he wants the Cheerios. So this is a little bit different. Because this is saying we don't actually want them. At this time, you know, so much Jewish money is coming into Israel to purchase Jewish land. We don't want, you know, the land to be sold permanently, okay? But in any case, this is a point that we have to go back to. In any case, the text of the aforementioned contract will be formulated by the Jerusalem Rabbinical Court, and with their consent, following the affirmation sale, based on such a contract, it will be permitted to work the land as necessary, both the fields and the vineyards. It is understood that colonists who have the means and can afford to hire Gentile workers, we're going to come back to this point as well, and can afford to hire Gentile workers must not themselves do work that is forbidden during the Shemitah year. The poor, however, who lack the means to hire Gentile workers may do the work themselves, but only in accordance with the guidelines provided to them by the Jerusalem Rabbinical Court, who will instruct them in which labors are permitted and which are forbidden. All this applies only to the Shemitah 5649, but not to future Shemitah. Years of Shemitah, when a new allowance will have to be issued. Perhaps God in his great mercy will help deliver his people and bring them success so that they not need the allowance and they will be able to observe Shemitah in accordance with Torah law. We agree to the aforementioned allowance in its entirety, it being based on the law of our holy Torah, as we explained at length in separate booklets. All this was done on condition that it will be approved by the brilliant leader of our generation, the Honorable Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector of Beit Din of Kovno. Here they're invoking Rav Yitzchok Elchanan Spector. May God speedily bring our redemption so that we will be able to fulfill in the most meticulous manner all the mitzvot that depend upon the land of Israel. We attach our signatures on Friday, the 20th of Shvat, 5648, here in Warsaw. Yeshua Trunk of Kutna, Rishmol Moliver, Bialystok, and Rishmol Zonville Clapfish of Warsaw. Okay, so a number of things. I say number one, they invoke Pikuach Nefesh here. People are going to die. People are starving. So this is really an et lasot lashev. This is really a time to act. And you could counter and say, well, maybe nowadays it's different. Maybe nowadays we should not rely on the het mechila. We're not starving nowadays. Although maybe nowadays there are other considerations in making it available to the entire state of Israel to perform work in a way that, according to many rabbis, is completely acceptable. In other words, maybe once upon a time, the Heter Mechira was necessary because people were starving and these yeshuvim and these moshavot were going to fail. Maybe nowadays we don't have the same concerns, although maybe nowadays our concerns are different. We want to make it as accessible and easy for the entire state of Israel, many who are not religious, most of whom are not religious, to observe Shemitah. And if you would not allow them a Heter Mechira, they would work their land and sell their produce without a Heter Mechira. And we're concerned about the entire state of Israel and all of its inhabitants and all the Jews here and the kosher consumer as well. So we'll revisit that Mitzvah Shem next week. But they say a number of other things as well. They write here in this tshuva, in this original hetter, is the first Heter Mechira from that year 5648. They write that, number one, ideally the work should be performed by a non-Jew, but if you cannot afford it, a Jew himself can perform the work, but it should be limited to only Yisurei D'Rabbanan, Melachot that are only rabbinically prohibited. As we mentioned, and they also are looking for the Gushpanka of Rav Yitzchok Elchanan Spector. So Rav Yitzchok Elchanan Spector also paskined. He wrote his own Heter Mechira, but he limited to only non-Jewish labor, performing only Melachot D'Rabbanan. In other words, he did not have this leniency of a Jew himself performing the work. Okay, Rav Yitzchok Elchanan allowed only non-Jewish labor to perform the work on their land, the land that they own. It's owned by a non-Jew. The work is performed by a non-Jew, and only perform Melachot that are D'Rabbanan. So we'll see, we'll sum up in a few moments, we'll see that the Heter Mechira is relying on a number of snifim lahakel, a number of different leniencies. As I said, people often make the mistake in thinking that Rav Kook somehow invented the Heter Mechira. Interestingly, before Rav Kook came to Eretz Israel, he was actually one of those who opposed the Heter Mechira while he was still in Europe. He only comes on the scene in 1904, and we'll discuss his approach to the Heter Mechira in subsequent shiurim. But Rav Yitzchok Elchanan Spector based himself on a precedent that was found in an earlier tshuva of the Shemen HaMaor, which is the Sefer of Rav Mordechai Robio, who's a posek, lived in the 18th century. He died in 1783. Rimon, in his book, publishes, you know, he has a nice little biography of a lot of these rabbis and publishes the Sharblat, the Daf HaShar, the frontispiece of the Sefer. So this is a Sefer, She'ilot U'Tshuvot Shemen HaMaor, by this 18th century post-sacred of Mordechai Robio, who was a Rav in Chevron after the Chida of Chaim Yosef David Azulai, who permitted the sale of a vineyard to a Gentile during the Shemitah year. Now, Rav Yitzchok Elchanan wanted to see the tshuva for himself. This, of course, was before the internet. This is before, you know, you could just fax someone a tshuva or email. This is before Bar Ilan digitized all the responsa. So he sent someone to Berlin to bring him a copy of the Sefer to Kovno, where he was living. Now, Baron Rothschild, of course, was very happy that they found a solution to the Heter Mechira. As I said, he was heavily invested in these moshavot. He feared their demise. He feared what that would mean for his ego. He wanted to move away from this reliance on handouts, on chalukah, as, by the way, did other early Zionist pioneers, even those who were not religious, like Eliezer ben Yehuda, the father of the modern Hebrew language, which we'll mention in a moment. The Heter Mechira is based on a number of assumptions. Number one, that according to most Rishonim and Achronim, the entire status of Shemitah nowadays is only Nidrabanan. As we explained in a previous shiur, by Yovel, the Torah says, Ukiratem dror ba'aretz lechol yoshveha, you're going to proclaim liberty throughout the land to all of its inhabitants. And the Gemara explains that Yovel only applies when there is kol yoshveha aleha. when all of its inhabitants are resting on that land. Now, what that means, we discussed. There are different opinions as to what that means. Do you need everyone? What about a majority? Do they need to be sitting in their ancestral plot or on their ancestral plot, in their nachala, according to each tribe? Okay, but Yovel is batel when you do not have kol yoshveha aleha. And Shemitah is dependent on Yovel. So Shemitah, without Yovel, is only derabbanan. We saw even a minor opinion, a dat yachid, a minority opinion, which suggests that Shemitah nowadays is only a minhag, only a midat chassidut. So based on that assumption, the heter mechira works. Because when it comes to rabbinic law, if the entire mitzvah of Shemitah, bizman hazeh, is only the rabbanan, we invoke b'makom pseida, lo gazur rabbanan, or b'makom hefset, lo gazur rabbanan. We can be lenient with a rabbinic law, or with rabbinic mitzvot, if there is a major loss to one's parnasa, to one's livelihood. If one's livelihood is at stake, and that certainly was the case. In addition, there is an assumption that, as we mentioned, the sale of land in Eretz Yisrael removes it or releases the land from the obligation of Shemitah. It removes the obligation of Shemitah upon the land. It releases that land from Shemitah, allowing the land to be worked and the produce to be sold. We said that was the machloket between the Beit Yosef and the Mabit. But we assume, like the Beit Yosef, that if land is owned by a non-Jew, the laws of Shemitah don't apply to that land. That land is released from its obligation. Okay. Now, it's not so simple, because as we'll see next week when we explore opposition to the Heter Mechira, not all poskim followed the Beit Yosef. Some paskin like the Mabit. Okay. And another assumption of the Heter Mechira is that it's not in violation of this Isur of Lo Techonim, which we mentioned, Lo Titein Lahem Chanaya Bakarka, which we'll explore more next week when we discuss the opposition. This Torah prohibition of selling land to a Gentile. Can you sell land in the land of Israel to a non-Jew? What are the parameters of that prohibition? Is it only on selling to idolaters, or is it selling land to any non-Jew? And what if the sale is only temporary, it's only for a year? And what if the sale doesn't undermine your hold on the land, but just the opposite, strengthens your hold on the land? So we're going to discuss that more next week. But some of the opposition said, Shemitah bizman hazeh is only the Rabbanan, it's only rabbinic. So by trying to find a solution to a rabbinic issue, a rabbinic mitzvah, you are in violation of a Torah prohibition of Lo Techonim. It's like you're running away from a fox into the hands of the lion, into the arms of the lion. Okay, we'll discuss that more next week. The old yeshuv flat out refused to accept the Heter Mechira, at least this first year, Shemitah of 1881, 1882. And they were angry with Rothschild. They felt Rothschild went around their back. They were angry at his land administrators, saw them as anti-religious, antagonistic to religion. They felt that Rothschild was being pressured by these new Chovevei Tzion, these new, more modern, broad, worldly Jews from the new yeshuv who wanted to work the land and set up these agricultural settlements and till her soil and roll up their sleeves and drain the swamps. And the old yeshuv began to see the new yeshuv as anti-religious, as secularists. And this, you know, plants the seed for what's to come. Now, Rothschild, in turn, was angry with them, with the old yeshuv, of not following the rabbis who were in support of the Heter Mechira. Again, Rothschild was heavily invested in these yeshuvim, in these moshavot. And he also was concerned about what this would mean for the future. By now, you had rabbis from Eastern Europe weighing in on this. How is this going to affect the future aliyah? Maybe Jews aren't going to want to come and settle the land of Israel if they're concerned about this controversy surrounding Shemitah and this Heter Mechira. Okay? It's funny, I already mentioned Eliezer ben Yehuda, the father of modern Hebrew. So he had, as an early Zionist pioneer, in addition to being the father of modern Hebrew, who resurrected modern Hebrew language, and by the way, consulted with rabbis like Rav Chaim Hirschenson. People think that, you know, oh, he resurrected this Hebrew language, you know, that Yiddish is really the Lashon HaKadosh, Lashon HaKodesh, right? And Hebrew, modern Hebrew was resurrected by these, you know, anti-religious secularists, these secular nationalists, these Zionists. Eliezer ben Yehuda consulted with rabbis, and a lot of modern Hebrew, as you well know, is based on rabbinic Hebrew, based on the Hebrew of the Mishnah and the Hebrew of the Midrashic literature and the Talmud and the Rambam. In any case, Eliezer ben Yehuda was very much invested in this as well. And he also hoped, like Rothschild, for a reasonable solution to Shemitah, which would encourage more Jews to settle in the land of Israel. Initially, he was happy with Shmuel Salant, encouraging people to keep the Shemitah and we'll get through it. But when Shmuel Salant in 1881, in advance of that Shemitah, refused to rely on the Heter Mechira, Eliezer ben Yehuda calls him the chief enemy of the new Yeshuv. Wow. Did not mince any words. Chief enemy of the new Yeshuv. And this controversy, which surrounds the Heter Mechira, begins to draw clear lines in the sand between the old Yeshuv and the new Yeshuv, between religious and secular, and in many ways shapes the religious and political landscape as we know it today. And you start to see the beginning of divisions between Haredi, Tzioni Dati, Chiloni communities. In many ways, the Heter Mechira and the controversy which surrounds the Heter Mechira really begins to shape the religious and political landscape as we know it today in the modern state of Israel. Things only become exacerbated with the second Aliyah between 1904 and 1914, which was an Aliyah of mostly secular Zionists and a major Aliyah. Okay, we'll talk about that more, Mirtz Hashem, next week. By the next Shemitah, the Shemitah of 1888-1889, most of the communities in the nascent Yeshuv did rely on the Heter, but some still did not. By now, Rothschild had more control over these settlements. And by now, the Heter became more accepted by rabbis. Of course, as you know, over time, you know, Chadash Asar Min HaTorah, as is often attributed to the Chasam Sofer, though it's Lashon of Chazal, but anything new is verboten, it's forbidden. But with time, these things become accepted and ultimately adopted. Even Rav Shmuel Salant, who was virulently against the Heter Mechira originally, was said to have, at least in discussing the matter, not in writing, but in discussing the matter, agreed to a limited application of the Heter Mechira, as Rav Yeshua Leib Diskin, the Brisker Rav of Yerushalayim, who again too was virulently against the Heter Mechira at the beginning, he also supposedly approved a limited application of the Heter. Over time, there is more support, but also more opposition. And we'll discuss next week Rav Kook, what happens when Rav Kook arrives on the scene in 1904, and his Bar Plukta, the Rav in Tzfat, the Ridvaz, as well as later the arrival of the Chazon Ish on the scene, and his opposition to the Heter Mechira. And we'll also look at how it was adopted and implemented following the founding of the State of Israel and what the status of the Heter Mechira is today. But it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating, to consider how this controversy really shapes religious life in so many ways in the modern state of Israel as we know it today. Questions, comments? And that only, that polarization only becomes more extreme over time with the second Aliyah. As I said, this is a controversy that, you know, rears its head every 7 years. It's so divisive even today. But we'll see, you know, how with the second Aliyah, just how that exacerbated the situation and things become even more polarized. Yes. Oh, that's a wonderful book. Yes, Rebels in the Holy Land by Sam Finkel about Maskeret Batya. Right. I think Baruch Hashem, we've reclaimed that history, and I think there are many who are familiar with this movement of early religious Jews early Zionist pioneers coming and founding these agricultural settlements. I think that we've reclaimed that history. I think people are familiar, but you're correct in that. Unfortunately, it is not taught in schools, at least the schools that I went to. We'll talk about Rav Kook and what happens when he becomes the Rav of Yafo in 1904. We'll talk more next week about Rav Kook. Okay. I'm going to leave you with a cliffhanger. Have a wonderful day, everyone. A great week.